Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm really excited to bring you today's webinar on credit reporting and COVID-19. I apologize in advance because it looks like I haven't shaved, but my almost 15-year-old son challenged me to a competition last week that he could grow a beard, a longer beard than I can. So I have to stand up for myself. So that's why I'm not shaving. But I appreciate you joining us today for a very important topic. Perhaps no law has created more confusion in credit collection industry during the coronavirus pandemic than the Fair Credit Reporting Act. We've got Congress, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and state attorneys general are all weighing in on how credit reporting should be handled during the crisis, which has resulted in more questions than answers. Today, we've got a panel of leading compliance experts here to discuss how companies should be managing this important process. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Mike Frost is a partner at Malone Frost Martin. His practice is primarily focused on compliance, general counsel services, and litigation defense for the armed industry. He has 15 years of experience as an executive at a large collection agency where he was responsible for legal, compliance, government affairs, legal operations, sales, and marketing. Mike serves on the board of directors at ACE International and is a speaker on a variety of industry topics and trade for many trade associations. Joanne Needleman is a leader of the Consumer Financial Services Regulatory and Compliance Group at Clark Hill. She's a past president of the board of directors of the National Creditors Bar Association and also served on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Consumer Advisory Board. Rick Purr is a co-managing partner of the Philadelphia office of the law firm of Kaufman, Dolowich & Voluck. He also chairs the firm's National Consumer Financial Services Practice Group. He is nationally recognized in lectures on creditors' rights, representing creditors, law firms, and agencies against individual and class action allegations, invoking federal and state consumer protection laws, including the FDCPA, the FCRA, and the TCPA. Rick is a past president of ACA International and currently sits on its board of directors. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please enter it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel or send it through the chat module. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. With that, let's launch into our discussion. And first, let's maybe take a start at a high level and take a step back and maybe summarize what's happened in the past 2 months related to credit reporting. Rick, would you mind taking us through that?
Sure. I think that with the COVID-19 crisis and the rush by governments, both at the federal and state level, as well as creditors, to try and deal with what is really an unparalleled economic crisis, has led to a little bit of inconsistencies amongst all of these entities in trying to tell people what to do about credit. Most people recognize the issue and the problem, which is people are making less money, in some cases being furloughed, laid off, having salaries cut, and the ability to pay their bills is having a significant economic impact. And so you have many different entities that are all reaching out to say, how do we deal with it? And in doing so, they're putting forward sometimes competing descriptions of how furnishers of data need to convey the information to consumer reporting agencies. The consumer reporting agencies themselves are coming up with conflicting opinions of how to handle this. And creditors are directing those people who are furnishing data to do things in different ways. Combine that all with the government saying at the state and federal level, maybe you should do this, maybe you should do that, or treat unpaid debts from in a different way for periods of time, which are ambiguous as to how long that is going to last. So to try and sum it up, to assemble it into a nutshell there, there's a lot of different things going on. And I don't know that there's any real clear pronouncements as to how everybody needs to act.
All right, so we're off to a confusing start. Good. Mike, Joanne, anything you want to add on top of what Rick said so far?
No, I I think he summarized it very well. There is just a lot of conflicting information out there, and it's just amazing to me of who's giving the information and the lack of understanding of the industry when this information comes out, which makes it, you know, really frustrating for us as attorneys trying to advise our clients, and very difficult for our clients in trying to figure out what's the best possible path if in fact they are credit reporting. So it's been really frustrating and head scratching at the same time.
And I just wanted to thank you, Mike, for having me today. I didn't realize I was going to be presenting with two past presidents. Pretty amazing now. But thanks again for putting this together. I think the Rick summarized it well, and Joanna did the right type of comments. It's really one of those areas in during COVID-19 that there's just not really great answers, and you have to look at the entire scope and makeup of your company and how you're reporting today, and determine, you know, from your perspective and best interest, you know, how are you going to report? But you know, I think it's really one of those areas. I think most of the areas we've gotten some pretty good clarity on things. There's been some pretty good FAQs on things, and it's still coming out during COVID-19. But the one area that's really up in arms and people don't have a real clear understanding is credit reporting. Hopefully we don't muddy the waters any further today, but hopefully we can give some guidance. But it, you know, I would just say, I don't think if you're on the call today asking for that, you know, golden goose of this is exactly what I need to do, I don't think you're going to get that from any of the three of us. Maybe you are, but I you know, not for me for sure.
No promises.
I would just say that I just want to hit on what Joanne said, which is she was 100% accurate in terms of the people that are making these pronouncements in large part don't really understand credit reporting.
Right.
Because, you know, credit reporting has two goals. One is from the people that are providing the data in terms of accuracy, but also there are people who are reading the data in trying to make credit decisions. And so when you have this legislation or pronouncements from government bodies, it's tough to tell which side of the coin they're directing those pronouncements towards. Are they trying to make it so that the information is accurate? Or are they trying to make it so that people can get more credit by sort of muddying the waters in terms of credit granting, so that a credit grantor will be more likely to provide credit to somebody, which ultimately could end up in a default or a situation that affects you know, the rest of the consumers. So, I mean, I think Joanne's 100% on board, which is why it's one of those problems.
We've got our first question that's come in, so I'll use this as an opportunity to remind everybody, if you have a question, type it into the Q&A button or Q&A module or the chat module, and we'll ask it at the panel. Our first question is there any suggestion for how long agencies are to use the special comment AW natural disaster as advised by the CDIA? Does anyone want to tackle that one?
I would say we would be guessing. I'm looking at that right now. Right now, we're still in a quote, there's still emergency declarations that are in specific states. There's still a FEMA declaration that's, I think, the first time in maybe since World War II that we've had a national FEMA declaration. Usually it's in a particular region. But I think we have to look to the governments to see what they can, you know, what the state of our world is before you can make that decision. But I unfortunately don't think we can answer that question. And I don't think I would be comfortable saying, June 1st, you don't have to do that. I think that would be a mistake.
All right, I think that there are, I mean, if you look at the sources of what this declaration is, you have state governments, which individually are coming up with deadlines within their own states about how long their statewide emergencies are. And that's understandable given the fact that the virus has affected people differently depending upon where you live. You have the federal government, which has identified some degree of an emergency. And at the same time, and that's when I say the federal government, I mean the executive branch of the federal government. And then you have Congress, which is enacting legislation through the CARES Act and other repetitive areas. And if you look at some of the legislation that's being promulgated or discussed, particularly as they're starting to talk about debt collection, they are envisioning concepts like 120 days after the declaration ends. You know, what does that mean in terms of things such as that we're being asked? And the question is that going to mean that if you're dealing with this declaration, you should be putting this code 120 days after, because it seems to be some sort of congressional intent? And there really is no answer.
Yeah, I would echo those comments. And the other question is, you know, you look at states like Nevada and they throw up a different argument. Can you even use the AW code based on the fact that they prohibit all debt collection activity entirely? And case law will tell you that, you know, credit reporting activity is considered debt collection activity in and of itself. So, you know, I think it's going to be, you know, to your both points, is it's going to be a state by state and sometimes a locality type issue that we have to look at to determine when we can actually remove that code. The other thing that we've heard a lot about is code doesn't really impact the credit score. So there's really no negative impact to the consumer. So is there actually, you know, standing for the consumer to bring in some type of an action based on the AW code, since there's no negative repercussion for that code? There's no impact or negative issues for the consumer. So, you know, it still remains to be seen how those claims are going to come out and how they're going to evolve. We know that they're going to happen. we all know that. So it's just, you know, making that business decision to determine when the right time is based on that specific location of the consumer and if that impact is still there for the consumer or not. And it's an individual type issue. That's the difficulty, I think, from an operational perspective, is how do you manage the AW code throughout the cycle, if it applies to a specific consumer or not, or if you do it across the board. I mean, there's multiple different ways to assess this and make that decision. But, you know, those are some of the questions I'm sure we're going to tackle today.
Mike, we did get a question. I think it was intended for you, although maybe, you know, it was for me, but wondering how to get such a good haircut during quarantine, asking for referrals or any tips.
Yeah, actually, I have a daughter that's a beautician. So she came in and just, I told her to butcher me. I said, take it all off. And she left me a little.
There you go. More questions about the AW code. Does everyone get the AW code, or just debtors that are directly impacted? Those, for example, who mentioned that they lost their job. Another good question.
I think that was kind of what I was kind of alluding to, is I think there's, you know, framing this up, there's probably different ways that people have viewed how they're going to apply the AW code, if they've applied it at all, or if they've just deleted the entire trade line across the board and just re-report the ones that they feel that they should after this pandemic is over. So I think there's, you know, there's probably multiple different areas that you could look at. What you could do, nothing, which is probably going to get you in the crosshairs of plaintiff's counsel and probably regulators. You could take utilize the AW code on just accounts that, you know, the consumers identify that there's some type of impact to them specifically. But again, you're on a one-on-one type issue then for all of the thousands of accounts that you have to, you're going to have to, you know, deal with these on an individual basis. But the third way is, I think some companies have decided to just put the AW code across the board on all accounts. And I don't know that really applies, because many of the people that are, you know, this is different than a natural disaster. And that's the problem I have with the AW code is, you know, in a natural disaster area, you have a hurricane or a tornado that impacts a specific group of people. And I think truly that's what this code was provided for. It wasn't, you know, nobody anticipated COVID-19 or some type of health disaster. They figured this was a way to put a code on for a natural disaster. And that's different. You have people that are impacted based on, you know, some type of a, you know, structural impediment to where they live. This impacts everybody differently. I, you know, some of us have had family members that have been impacted by COVID-19, and some of us don't even know anybody that's been impacted by it, let alone ourselves. Some people actually have done better during the COVID-19 program because they're on unemployment and receiving more money than what they did when they were working. So I think the impact is unusual. It's not truly that I think what was developed through this code, knowing that people would be impacted by a natural disaster. So it, you know, it makes it difficult to just do that across the board with every account that you have in every jurisdiction. The other option is, do you just remove the trade line? And, you know, when you're in doubt of whether you know how to report something accurately, you know, you always have the right to remove those accounts from the credit bureau. They don't want you to do that. I don't think the regulators want us to do that. I don't think that the credit bureaus want us to do that. We want to keep the credit cycle is, you know, is up to date and accurate as possible. But when there's a question about your ability to be able to provide accurate data, you know, do you just keep the trade line on or do you remove it? I think that's another option. So there's, you know, there's so many different ways that you can, you know, look at this and view, you know, when or when you should not apply that code, if you should at all, that it'll impact, you know, how you do it and whether it's by debtor, individual debtors or by, you know, entire populations of accounts that you receive.
Anybody else want to add any more options that people might consider?
I think Mike covered it pretty well. It's just dependent on how you want to conduct the operation of your business. There is no right or wrong answer. And there's no guidelines, and there's nobody out there telling you have to do this or you have to do it this way. I think, unfortunately, to some degree, if what is determined to be a wrong way, if there is a wrong way, we'll see on the other side of this when consumers start to complain about what their consumer report looks like. I think that's inevitable that you will see people complaining about how their obligations are treated when this is all over. And the real question is unlike the FDCPA, which is a strict liability statute, the Fair Credit Reporting Act requires a degree of negligence or willfulness. The test is going to be on your customer service relationships and how you deal with people at that point in time, in either correcting, modifying, changing, like Mike said, taking it off, fixing it. At that point, when someone brings the complaint, you know, in a small C, not a capital C, and how you handle that will determine whether or not people are going to file something, bring a lawsuit at some later point in time.
Looking at the, I guess we'll call it the rock in the hard place, where the CFPB on one side and state attorneys general on the other, to the extent you can offer any guidance, what would you say to companies about who they should be listening to, who they should, you know, how to sort of manage their way through this process, especially if they're in a state where the attorney general has gone to the CFPB, gone to the credit bureaus and said, you know, you've got to follow the CARES Act. You know what, you know, let's spend a few minutes sort of discussing the options there. Joanne, can you kick us off?
Sure. So I think let's start with the CARES Act, which specifically addressed and specifically amended the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And I think what the CARES Act tries to do is prevent delinquent trade lines. They talk about, accommodations if a consumer calls and says, I lost my job and, I want to pay $50 a month or I can't pay or there's a deferment. Accommodation is defined in the CARES Act very broadly. It really can mean anything. So you can make those accommodations, but you have to continue to mark that account as current. Now, what's interesting about the CARES Act, and again, goes to the point we were making before, how little people understand the industry. The real, you know, it only is really for first parties, because if the account is charged off, the section of the CARES Act just doesn't apply. So that's, you know, I don't know how much, you know, in first party situations, yeah, if you're 30 days late, maybe under the contract, you're not in default, maybe it'll come up on a credit report. But the real credit reporting problems usually have on the third party end, because that's where you have a charge off, that's where you have some significant delinquency. And nothing in the CARES Act applies to that. I found it really, to me, again, head scratching, the letter that the 23 or so attorneys general sent to Kathleen Kraninger. The CARES Act is a collaboration of a zillion different bills. It's got stimulus, it's got PPP, it's got grants to certain industries. And then mixed in there was the credit reporting and moratoriums on foreclosures and evictions. And the PPP in the law, excuse me, the CARES Act in itself said, okay, we're going to enact these laws. You agencies then have to issue rules or guidance. And you've seen the SBA and the Treasury issue guidance on PPP. Well, the CFPB, because of Fair Credit Reporting Act, of which they have authority, had to issue some sort of rule and guidance to make us understand what was involved. I actually thought they did a really good job, because the only thing they didn't do was really differentiate between first party and third party creditors. It's a very subtle distinction. But I think the letter from the AGs, again, shows a complete disregard of what the industry, of what credit reporting is all about, and the complexities of credit reporting and doing disputes. I mean, it's hard enough to do a dispute in 30 days. I think her extending it 15 days to 45 days is not detrimental to anybody, especially since if someone's complaining about their credit report, they're not even working. I mean, it's not like they're not looking to go buy a house or go buy a car. Everybody's sitting at home. So I think the CFPB did, I think, a pretty good job quickly of providing some guidance on what that portion of the CARES Act is about. I'm disappointed in the attorney generals for kind of breaking it wide open and making it into a battle that they didn't need to make. I don't think anybody is going to be, again, harmed by a delay in disputing. You still have to investigate the dispute. You still have to do it reasonably. You still have to document it. And what the CFPB also said is there's going to be a situation, especially in the third party world, where you're going to want to make an accommodation and you need to report that accurately. That is, the CARES Act doesn't touch that at all. And you still have obligations under the FCRA to do that. So again, a lot of confusion. I wish we could provide more clarity here, but I just think it's unfortunate that you've got now this political war going on in relation to the CARES Act and the guidance.
I also want to add that I think that in following up with what Joanne says, there just sometimes seems to be a fundamental disconnect on the behalf of people in government who just take a look at something and say, it's a company, it's monolithic, it exists on its own, without recognizing that a company is a composite of all its employees. So when they make these edicts that say, you have to do this, you have to do that, it totally disregards the fact that in a lot of cases, many of these companies, particularly data furnishers, which are smaller entities and not the large companies, either have people who can't work, who are being kept home from work, who are themselves furloughed, or for the survival of the company need to do other things that they can't immediately get to, or don't prioritize credit reporting disputes and handling them as the number one thing to do to survive as a company. And so when you put that challenge of putting people against each other, what the CFPB does is it recognizes that companies can no longer operate in a traditional manner that they're used to because they don't have the manpower to do it. And so they're giving them that understanding of, if you're not able to get it within that period of time, and most of us who are involved with companies understand that in a lot of cases, the run-of-the-mill disputes that come in through the ACDVs and others are handled in a relatively short period of time and are done in less than 30 days, except that the situation's a little bit more complicated. But for those scenarios, don't put yourself out there where you have to struggle to meet a deadline out of fear of a reprisal because you don't have the manpower or capability to do it. And then you have the flip side where you have the state attorney generals who, by the way, don't have jurisdiction over the FCRA, pushing the CFPB for protecting, in their viewpoint, these companies and not protecting consumers, when in fact the consumers are the very people that are working in these companies in the first place. So it's a circular argument. And at the end of the day, if you have to put one over the other, clearly the CFPB has jurisdiction in the area. The attorneys general do not.
Yeah. And I would just add it, I think the comments were that they were not going to take a backseat on enforcement. What does that mean? I don't really know. I think I agree with you both that the CFPB took a very good pragmatic approach to it and tried to understand how COVID-19 is impacting everyone, not just consumers, but also the businesses that directly work with them. And I really, you know, agree with her sentiment, which is, you know, provide a little bit of extra time if you need to be able to provide the information accurately to the consumers that they requested. You know, having this crammed down from the AGs is probably not real beneficial to anybody, including consumers. But like we've said it already, I don't know that they connect real well with the underlying business or understand it well enough to be able to make those assumptions.
I'm curious, you know, we've clearly, you know, illustrated the confusion, the chaos that's out there, the lack of clarity, to use, I think, maybe a word that everybody has used. What is it going to take to resolve this? Is it going to, you know, or is this something where it's just going to be like this until this, you know, the pandemic is over and the states of emergency are rescinded? Or is there some way else that this, that there can be some sort of resolution in the meantime?
Well, I think that, you know, people should just continue in the case of A, credit reporting in their normal course of their business as their capabilities allow. On new debt, if there is a restriction on collection activity in the state, i.e. Nevada, for example, you know, as Mike said early on in our conversation, that putting a new item on a credit report is considered collection activity by the Federal Trade Commission. Passively leaving something on a credit report and not touching it is not considered credit activity. So if there's a restriction on engaging in collection activity in your state, then you shouldn't touch someone's trade line. But other than that, just go through the normal process. If you get a dispute, try and do it as timely as you can. If it lasts beyond the 30 days, it lasts beyond the 30 days. I don't think that you're going to see an uptick during this particular period of time with people filing lawsuits, but you may see after this is all over, like I noted before, as people just start to get a hold of their credit reports, you start to see the totality of the impact on them. If they see negative items, they're going to go to an attorney. Whether they have a cause of action or they don't have a cause of action, of course, will depend on the attorney they go to. But, you know, America's a litigious society. So I don't anticipate the numbers of lawsuits going down after all this is over, and determining what's right or wrong won't be decided in 2020. It'll be decided in 2021 and 2022.
You know, I also think, as we're seeing and from a collection standpoint, the rate of inbound calls that are coming into agencies now really in some ways is unprecedented. That's what's being reported to me. And so I think, you know, consumers have a lot of questions. They're going to be asking a lot of credit, to the extent that they're calling an agency that is reporting them, or they're calling a creditor that is on their credit report. They're going to have questions. And I think it's important that there's kind of a heightened level of training that maybe that's going on right now that you wouldn't have before, so that your agents can answer questions for consumers. They're going to want to know, you know, how will this payment plan affect my credit report? And you have to be able to tell them, because, you know, if you give them the wrong information, to Rick's point, you know, it's all going to come back to haunt us at the end of this year and into 2021. So I think you really need to dust off some of your policies and procedures when it comes to communicating with consumers, consumer-facing information, when there's questions about credit reports.
Yeah, and I think we've talked a lot about, you know, the plaintiff's bar and how they're, you know, are probably already framing up what's the arguments that we're going to make coming out of COVID-19, what are the areas that they can focus on to, you know, create lawsuits, which we know all happens. You know, and this is an area that we're probably going to see it. There's a lot of questions. I mean, we've seen an increase in FCRA cases over the years, and we've seen a decrease in FDCPA and TCPA cases. So the focus is already on credit reporting. We see call baiting all the time in this industry about credit reports. They ask questions to agents to try to get them to violate the regulation by saying something they're not supposed to. I mean, it's not going to change the impact on how, you know, on what we're going to see after the fact. It's going to, this is going to be an area that we're going to have to deal with. And, you know, a lot of the cases that we've seen before COVID-19 were pretty detailed arguments about how a collection agency updated a credit bureau history with an XB versus an XH code. I mean, I think we probably all of us have seen those types of cases coming through, and we've had some success behind it, but it doesn't stop or prevent the litigation from starting. And that's where the dollars start ticking for agencies, is once the lawsuit, you know, is filed, then, you know, they're potential risk there from a cost perspective. You know, the one way to avoid that is to not report. You know, and people are always going to say, you know, reporting actually helps us collect money. Well, sometimes it may or may not. Maybe it's worth it. Maybe it's not. Any new accounts that you're getting, I would just recommend people not to report new accounts for the time being. I think that question actually popped up in our chat box here too, is, you know, does this apply to all debts that we're, you know, working through today, that we are actively working through during or prior to COVID-19, or is it just only apply to the accounts that are new? And it applies to all of them. But you can treat those differently. If you have accounts that are coming in and you don't want to report them, you don't have to. There's nothing that requires you as a data furnisher to report accounts to the Bureau. You don't have to report everything to the Bureau. And thankfully, there's a lot of creditors that do their own reporting, which truly, in my opinion, that's where it should reside. The creditors own the account. They understand where the account began, and they understand where it ends. And, you know, there's some areas like in telecom where we see credit reporting that may last on somebody's consumer report at one agency for 6 months, and then it moves to another agency, and it does that cycle for, you know, quads to quints. You know, what impact is that having on consumers, and what impact is that having on collections and recoveries? I don't know what's the best program. So, you know, when you think about this in totality, it's, if you have anything new coming in, absolutely, just don't report it, and you're going to avoid the liability. You're going to have operations people argue that it collects money. Well, prove it. I haven't seen a lot of data around that before, other than the one-off cases where somebody calls in because they want to buy a house, and something's on the credit bureau. Beyond that, at a really large scale, especially on high volume, low balance accounts, doesn't really have that major of an impact on your ability to recover in total. So there's a lot of things that you have to think about, you know, when you go into the reporting phase, and whether you're going to do it or continue it, or how you're going to, you know, apply some of these codes.
And just to emphasize something that Joanne and Mike both brought up, particularly in this environment, one is that giving an incorrect information about credit reporting could be an FDCPA violation, mm-hmm. because they're going to say that you're using some deceptive means to collect a debt. And somewhat exacerbating that problem today, if you are dealing with work from home scenarios, is in a lot of cases, while your employees are working from home, you're not recording their calls. So the exact content of the call may not be recoverable by you to be able to show you did or didn't say something, in which case you're left with a court case of I didn't say that versus somebody saying I said that, particularly if there's no recording. And as a he said, she said litigation, all you're really helping are people like Mike and I and Joanne in terms of giving us fees to try cases for a jury to do a coin flip over who are they going to believe. So, which is really never the best use of your money. So be cautious in giving out advice to people about what the status of the law is on credit reporting, and training your employees that way. And if you are having people work from home and you're not recording calls, be doubly cautious.
Is this one of those situations where the ambiguity allows for a company to say, as long as a company has documented policies and procedures, and they're, let's, you know, in air quotes, they're reasonable, if something happens and they get sued, you know, because they really sort of weren't understood, you know, there's so much lack of so much lack of clarity out there. Does that, having that documented policy and procedure, enough, you know, when you get in front of a judge? Or is it something where, you know, an agency is going to have to sort of pick a side and, you know, figure out which way they want to go in terms of how they want to handle addressing the confusion out there?
I would first start by saying I hate the bona fide error defense as a lawyer. clients seem to like it. I don't like it. Why? Because it's guilty by reason of insanity is about the closest analogy that you can have for people to understand. It's basically saying, I acknowledge we messed up, but here's my defense. And if you're going to court already conceding that you messed up and you're hoping to get off because your burden of proof is going to be showing that we had reasonable procedures in place, jury question, or that, you know, the policies existed and how reasonable they are, again, most of the time, jury questions. I mean, you're going to in front of a jury saying, I am responsible, but you should get me off for this reason. That's just a really bad place to be instead of not having the problem in the first place. So I'll just throw that out in terms of if your reliance is bona fide error defense, that's just a tough place to start. And as a lawyer, we hate to see it for our clients because it almost always means jury trial. And that's just a lot of money.
Well, how would it also, I mean, there is no bona fide error defense in the FCRA. So, I mean, that wouldn't even, having a reasonable policy and procedure wouldn't even get off the ground in that kind of situation?
Well, there's a negligence standard. In other words, it's not strict liability in the FCRA. You have negligence and willfulness. I mean, you know, your argument would be we were negligent. It kind of ties in the same thing. There is the scienter requirement for us lawyers with the FCRA, which is good because it doesn't mean just because something bad happened, you're responsible. But again, not having the problem is always the best than saying we have a problem and we just did it negligently. You end up in the same, almost the same spot in terms of how you defend the case.
Let me bring up another point, and I don't need this to scare everybody, but let's give a healthy dose of reality here. Let's talk about it from a regulatory standpoint and from examinations and supervision. So right now we have a letter from Kathleen Craninger that said, look, you know, we understand we have COVID, we're gonna set out this policy, you're gonna do the best you can, and we're gonna understand that when we come in to examine you or supervise you. Well, let's think about 2021. Do we have a Kathleen Craninger? Do we have someone else at the CFPB? We may or we may not, I don't know. But, you know, as all of this, as Rick and Mike, and I know, you know, in representing clients who are either under CID or supervision, they do years and years look back. So in a couple years from now, or maybe even 2021, you know, you could, whoever is the head of the CFPB, or maybe she's still there, but you still have your enforcement and your supervision people who've been there for a long time, you're going to get a CID, and it could ask for this time period and how they view how you trained your employees, what information that you gave them is going to be really, really important. So I don't think that the CFPB's letter was a free pass. I think it's guidance. I think you have to really, as Rick said, people are working from home now. How are you monitoring? How are you supervising them? How do you know what they're saying? So it's really important that you get those training and policies and you document them and you make sure you send them to them in an email and you confirm that they printed them out and read them or they signed something. Because those are the kind of things that CFPB and maybe even state regulators are gonna look at. They might not have jurisdiction over the FCRA, but they have jurisdiction over UDAP or whatever state equivalent is of UDAP. Look at Massachusetts, they have their own sort of mini FCRA statute when it comes to accuracy of reporting. All of that's going to come into play after all this is over. There is going to be a look back. And be very careful in the state that you're in about who's doing the look back.
Not to scare anybody, though.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. We got a couple of questions that have come in, Mike, to something you were talking about a little while ago. Essentially, with regards to companies who are credit reporting, can they stop and then start again? Can they put a code on and take it off again? what would you advise there?
Yeah, I think you can do either of those. And, you know, the thing is you have an absolute right as a data furnisher if you don't know how to report something to take it off the bureau. The fact is today you're in a situation where you may not know. I don't know. I don't know if AW is, you know, on every single account is the right way, if AW code on just the ones that are impacted is the right way, or deleting the trade lines the right way. But at the end of the day, as a data furnisher, you're required to provide accurate information to the bureaus. And if you're in a position where you don't feel like you provide accurate information, you absolutely have the right to delete it. Mm-hmm. If you have a new account and you choose not to report it, there's nothing in the law that requires you to report delinquent accounts to the credit bureau. So you can choose not to report those accounts. And many companies have taken the approach even before COVID-19 that credit reporting is not worth it because there's so much hassle around it, and it doesn't really impact their recoveries enough for them to take the risk to deal with all the litigation, that they just have chosen as companies not to report at all. And clients that mandate it, they basically just walk away from that business. So there, you have options. You're not forced by any means to report accounts. Now, making the selection to report an account requires you to fall underneath those data furnisher requirements. So to Joanne's point, if the regulatory agencies come knocking and they have asked questions about it, they're going to look at the scope and process that you had in place and determining at that point, based on whatever set of criteria they determine is accurate at that time, on what you should have done during that time frame. Now, does that mean they're going to fine you? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Does it mean that they're just going to give you an MRA to revise the practice that you're dealing with today? That's a possibility too. So I don't know what to tell you that's going to happen from a regulatory perspective in the future and what mechanism they're going to use to enforce any of this stuff. But I can tell you, you have rights as a data furnisher. And then one of those rights is that you're not required to report. And when you're in a situation where you're not sure what you're reporting or how you're reporting, if it's inaccurate or accurate, you always have the right to remove that from the bureau. Nobody wants that. The regulators don't want it. The credits, our entire credits system is built upon this bureau reporting process. So we don't want to impact that negatively. And that's why I think we've gotten an awful lot of recommendations to drop this code on it and deal with it that way, instead of people removing those from the bureau. But you think about it from an agency perspective, and where's the area that you're most likely not going to be sued is if you're not reporting your accounts to the bureau. If you are, there's a potential to be sued in whatever code you put on it, whether it's AW, if you've got a dispute during this time frame. There's one thing that's interesting is the compliance conditional codes, which is your XB, XC, XH, all those different codes. When there's this dispute that comes in, you still have to update that properly. The AW additional code is just that. It's an additional code. It's not replacing those codes. So you have to make sure that that's being handled properly too. And there's a lot of work that goes on. As an agency shareholder in my past, you know, we had teams of people that dealt with this because it's a really complex issue, and you have to make sure that you do it properly because it's a really quick way to end up in litigation and pay out all the profits that you're getting on accounts that you're trying to work to begin with. So, you know, that's the big question is really, internally, how do you have the capability to be able to perform this? And if you don't have the expertise in-house to do it and you don't have the manpower to do it, maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
And now's the time with everything going on to consult with either your compliance people in-house or going externally to a lawyer to come up with a policy, come up with a plan, do something proactively now and not wait to see if what you're doing is wrong. I mean, I think that if you have a good plan and you're treating accounts either uniformly or you're doing something that with a workflow that if a question comes up, how do you handle it? I think that'll be looked at favorably by regulators later on in case you get into that mix. But with the COVID-19 crisis and with people being on a downtime and with you getting control of your, you know, really everyone's streamlining their operations right now, it may be the perfect time to be having those conversations.
Mm-hmm. All right, some more questions have come in. Does anybody have any opinion on reporting SBA loans in terms of including an AW code on those?
Well, a real question would be, how would you be putting an SBA loan in terms of a consumer report? even though, you know, if you are a personal guarantor on a SBA loan, it would be subject to, you know, being sent to the Bureau. Although at this point in time, the only person that would be dealing with an SBA loan would be the creditor, which would be the bank / SBA. So I don't know how that would even make its way onto somebody's personal report right now.
Good question. If anybody has any more, you know, information they want to share about that, feel free to submit it and we'll re-ask the question. Another one, instead of hundreds of thousands of data providers being tasked with interpreting and changing processes, why wouldn't the bureaus be in the best position to continue to receive data as normal, and then they affect how data reported during this time frame affects consumers' reports? It seems like the directives would be more efficiently be directed toward the 3 to 4 bureaus instead of all the furnishers. Does anyone have any opinion about that comment?
Well, I'll weigh in and give you, I will disclose my biased view towards consumer reporting agencies, which is from an agency side, you work with them. We're on the same team, but they're not necessarily your friend, because they're for-profit businesses that are, they're not the government. They're set up in a way that they sell their services to creditors, get reports, use them to make sure that you're getting credit-worthy people. On the flip side, they're also selling their services to the data furnishers to supply information. And, you know, they're also involving the consumers to get their reports, whether it's free or for paid services. So their best interests sometimes aren't your best interest as a data furnisher. And in that regard, the government telling them what to do, they're still private entities and they're trying to maximize their economic viability to these multitude of people who use their resources for all different reasons. So yeah, in an ideal world, government would tell them directly what to do, but they don't have the motivation to necessarily do it because they're communicating with 3 or 4 different groups of people who themselves have their own self-interest. And it's a difficult way to do it. To protect yourself in your best way, make sure you protect yourself, because the bureaus are not going to go about uniformly applying their procedures. And you can see that just with the reports today. You know, how many times have we had lawsuits or we've had things where a particular trade line appears on one of the 3 bureaus but doesn't appear on the others? It's characterized in a different way on one than in the others. So it's difficult because they do not act collectively, they do act in their own self-interest.
Let me just also add, I mean, again, going back to what we talked about at the beginning of this webinar, you know, it's to me, you know, these directives are coming out for people who have no understanding of the industry. I mean, look at the CARES Act. The CARES Act doesn't say anything about credit bureaus. It lays it all on the furnishers. They could have easily said, credit bureaus, you have to do A, B, and C. I mean, if furnishers, you know, send information to you under, you know, these set of circumstances, you shouldn't report it. I mean, there could have been all kinds of amendments to the FCRA, which would have put additional responsibilities on the bureaus, but Congress chose not to do that. So, I mean, that's unfortunate.
And they, you know, the credit bureaus have a very big lobbyist group.
Exactly. So
that's probably why that didn't end up in the regulation.
Right. Absolutely.
So the big thing is we're asking the bureaus, do they want to take on the liability? That's essentially what we're saying. Hey, bureaus, would you like to take on the liability? Do you think anybody's just going to accept that?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's a credit bureau or another company. No company's just going to upright and say, hey, there's not really good clear guidance on this, but let's go ahead and take the liability on. Nobody's going to do that. So I don't think anybody's going to volunteer for it. Would it be a better way to handle it? Probably, but at the same point, again, we've got more lobbyists and we also have companies that are just not going to raise their hand and take on that liability. So, you know, we know it's not going to happen. I haven't seen anything directly from the bureaus that's providing guidance on this. I think all I've seen is, hey, go check out the CDIA, which is an association. None of the, that those rules are actually law, so there's nothing that you can actually defend yourself on other than the fact that you could take that document into court and try to use that as proof that you did everything you could to provide you know the best reporting that you could and most accurate reporting that you could based on what the association's put forward as guidance. But again, it's guidance. It's there's nothing there that's concrete. I think that's the answer to the question is the bureaus aren't just going to raise their hand and take on the liability, and they get sued just as much as the agencies do. Pretty much all the FCRA claims that we see have a focus on the bureaus. And if you look at the CFPB portal, even under the debt collection area for consumer complaints, Experian, Equifax, TransUnion are right at the top of all the complaints that come through. And that's self-selection from the consumers and how they're treating those complaints, but they show up in our database as debt collectors based on their credit reporting stuff. And as consumers not knowing how that process works and selecting them in that area, but we see it every single month in and month out, that the bureaus are at the very top of that list in the top 10 of all agencies receiving consumer complaints. So
going back to the on-off discussion we were having before, two questions. One, would you say it's safe to remove trade lines now, especially to prevent DNRs from the credit reporting agencies? Then the trade lines can be refurnished again in the future. And then the other question was, I thought there was a responsibility to report to the credit bureau if in fact disclosures in the credit application state that credit is being reported. Is there a liability that a company would have by not reporting and another entity extends credit upon that bad information?
Well, I think there's like a couple points there. One, and Mike said this earlier, there's no prohibition to removing a trade line. The furnishing of a trade line is a volitional action. It's a choice. It may be a contractual choice that you have because you have an agreement with the creditor who you're collecting on, that's what you're going to do. And that's between you and the creditor in determining whether you're fulfilling that obligation or not. But there's no legal obligation to keep something on the credit report. Similarly, you have an agreement between you as a data furnisher and the bureau as to certain contractual obligations you have, which they frown upon you just removing things for the sake of removing it. But again, that's their economic model that I was talking about before. You have no, I guess it would be a really interesting thing, but I don't know that it would even fly, that you have any third party liability to a distant creditor who you didn't put something on a trade line. Thus, I granted credit to somebody who shouldn't have been granted credit. I'm sure there's disclaimers all over the place that TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax have that basically say, you can't sue us because you extended credit because we gave you information that wasn't in its, 100% accurate. I have no doubt that they're, and that would further extend to the people who provide that credit. I've never seen anything. I don't know if you've seen anything like that.
No, I haven't seen a collection agreement that requires an agency, to report based on a contractual obligation back to the consumer. Maybe that exists in some of the banking institutions or, that type of a revolving credit transaction or something like that, but not one that I've seen. I think most of those situations, the banks essentially that would be providing those types of loans would do their own credit reporting. And if you look at all the large banks do their own credit reporting anyway, if you're working on behalf of, some of those big, large banking institutions, you're not doing the reporting. You're not a data furnisher under the FCRA for them. They're handling it themselves. The government handles pretty much their own credit reporting. So you're not doing that as a data furnisher. Where we see most of this coming up is from the medical fields. And
And mortgage servicing.
Yeah, absolutely. Which very well could have something in those contracts that somebody's alluding to based on, the consumer agreeing to that. But, as a data furnisher and the vast majority of the accounts that I see anyway that are coming through our industry that are being reported on the healthcare front, and I'm pretty confident that's not on an intake form that you have to credit report the the medical debt to the bureau. So I don't think that's going to be an issue in those situations.
One last request or request for insight and guidance, and I think it's a pretty interesting one. Here it is. We have had higher than normal call volumes pertaining to credit reporting and consumers claiming the item was never on before their AW condition code. Consumers are using credit assistance and repair apps, and that seems to be the largest percentage of these calls due to alerts they are receiving. We have audit trails from the credit reporting agency showing older reporting debts didn't just appear. Do you have any suggestions on how to prepare for the plaintiff's attorney we know is waiting in the wings?
Enter with caution.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a great response to that. I think if you're seeing that already, it's just tea leaves to what you can expect as coronavirus, you know, starts to evolve to past the point that we're under, you know, the states of emergency and things of that nature. You know, that question has arisen a couple of times here too in our chat group about, you know, when do we remove the AW code? And there's not a good answer. I think we kind of touched on that a little bit earlier, but this is the fear that we all had. I think all three of us, probably all four of us, including Mike here, we don't know exactly what's going to come of this AW code and the reporting processes. And it's an area of ambiguity, and that's where plaintiff's counsel look as an opportunity to create or fabricate some type of a lawsuit. I wouldn't be surprised that some of this stuff is being developed through baiting calls. We've seen those in the past where, you know, consumers will call up and even on out-of-stat debt, you'll call up and ask you a question about how they can pay the account and hoping that you don't make your out-of-stat disclosure and then pay their account just so they can create a lawsuit against you. So are those going to happen? More than likely. Are these happening in that situation? There's a possibility that they're already out ahead of the game trying to make some of those baiting calls to you today. So I'd be very cautious on how you respond to credit bureau requests from consumers today, especially when they pertain to this AW code. Clearly that person's trying to drive some type of a potential liability there.
I would say to the person who asked that question, you're actually doing the right thing. You say you have audit trails to show that it was there. Make sure that you still have maintained those records, you know, for the next year or two. It's going to be really important.
Excellent. Well, I think we've got all the questions. I think I did. If I didn't get to all your question, I apologize, but we have run out of time. So Joanne, Rick, Mike, thank you so much for joining us today and trying to help clear the waters a little bit on this incredibly important and confusing topic. I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Thanks for having us, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Appreciate All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for your participating. Stay tuned for more webinars in the near future. A recording of this one will be posted to my webinar recordings page on accountsrecovery.net the next day or so. I hope everybody stays safe, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.